seeing in our local communities, both where we live and invest, how can we support people in the affordable housing space? We do our best to protect value in our own markets where we invest by not just getting in and bringing rents up above market appropriate levels. We try to really, in our own investing and our own asset management, keep things fair.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Charlie Stevenson is an experienced business founder and passionate leader with a demonstrated history of working in the marketing, travel, hospitality, and real estate investment industries. He is currently scaling Acris Capital, a real estate investment business focused on multifamily assets and inland growth markets across the U.S. Charlie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sam. Happy to be here.
Hey, man, the pleasure's all mine. You know, the same questions ask everybody who comes on the show is, where did you start? Where are you now? And can you tell us just briefly, how did you get there?
Yeah. So I got started in entrepreneurship when I was back in college. I always loved to travel and studied abroad out in Italy. And while I was out there, ended up bringing some of my roommates and then ended up being most of my class on a ski trip up into the Alps to go skiing. I'm a big skier. And while I was doing this, I realized after the trip was all said and done, I made some decent money on it. I didn't even mean to, and realized there was a business opportunity here. So about 2 years later, I ended up returning to Italy and launching that business with some friends and scaled it up to, you know, a couple $1 million business, which we eventually sold. And that was kind of the start of my foray into entrepreneurship. Since then, I've started a couple other businesses, and I'm currently scaling that business, Acris Capital, which is in kind of the asset management space. Had some stints in the corporate management world as well, and kind of just realized the difference between being an entrepreneur with my own business versus working in another business for another set of leaders without any equity or ownership in the business. And just the choice was obvious. So started in marketing, made my way kind of randomly into investment management and multifamily investing after I quit the corporate world with my wife. And we went traveling for a year and a half and rented our home in Boston. So we realized that renting that puppy was generating passive income. If we had more of these, we could retire or at least make that the focus and have more time to travel and spend time with family. And kind of that was the seed of the business that's now around 500 units. We've about $70 million in assets under management in 4 states. And you asked how we got there. We built a small team with my wife and her former colleague in investment management. They're both chartered financial analysts and understood kind of the financial underpinnings of large investment deals. They used to underwrite large mortgage-backed security deals and trade them on Wall Street. So looking at a small multifamily, which is where we got started, was very, very small for them and easy for them to understand. Meanwhile, I'm just like along for the ride, bringing the entrepreneurial stuff, but right, they were helping to be the engine and the brain behind it all. So that's how we ended up getting there, was by building a smart, small team.
Right, man. And for those of you who aren't listening, the CFA exam, I know I began studying for it at one point and then said, man, that's way too much work. And it didn't fit where I was going with my direction in life. But I think what's that got, like a 30% pass rate or something like that?
Oh yeah, maybe even less for the second. There's a bunch of tests. There's a couple of tests. Christina and my other partner, Lin Yang, are really proud that they passed both tests the first time, which is really, really rare. Yeah. And they're smart cookies for sure. I couldn't even understand the questions on those tests when my wife first was reading them to me. I'm like, that's not English. That's some other bizarre language that you all speak. So it's crazy hard. Yeah.
Right, man. And good for you. I mean, so now we know that you married up. So
totally.
That's awesome. Man. Cool. I love it. So you guys started with a small team. You said, hey, look, I'm gonna bring on some really smart people who are gonna help me understand kind of the financial side of this. And I'm gonna kind of bring the vision, and then we're gonna go out and do it. So walk us through that. Like, what's that process been like? What are some things you guys have found have been challenging? What are some things that you think you've done right? Walk us through that process.
Yeah. So I think one thing that we did from the very beginning was it was definitely the combination of a couple of visions. It wasn't just like, oh, Charlie wants to get into real estate investing. Let's all do that because he's got the founder's vision. Sure. Actually, Lin Yang, our partner in Boston, she had first started investing in multifamily at the low of the economic downfall in 2009. She bought a multifamily in Boston, a 3-unit. And so she actually already had that basic skill and was like, hey guys, we had already started the business looking at a different asset class. And she was like, hey, we should look at multifamily because I already understand it. It's really predictable. It's an age-old, time-tested asset class. So we said, yeah, let's give this a kick. So we actually stopped looking at that other asset class. And we all came together before we invested in anything. We all came together in Sun Valley, Idaho, where my mom lives and where I've spent a lot of time. And we did like a week-long offsite. And we said, what is the foundation of our business? Like, what's important to us? Why are we doing this? What are we going to do? What does this look like over the short, medium, and long term? So we really took time to just fundamentally determine if we want to be in business together and what it is we're actually trying to produce. What's the end? Because it wasn't just money. Money is the means to the end, but the end for us was what everybody says, or a lot of people say, is the kind of the cliche freedom. We wanted to be able to have freedom to spend time with our families and freedom to travel the world, which is the things that are the most we're most passionate about. So we setting that as the top measure for our success. We then said, okay, well, what are the assets that are going to most likely get us there? And what do we have to get us there? And so that's when we started focusing on multifamily, because we had a little bit of some momentum built between mine and Christina's single door in Boston and Lin Ying's three doors in Boston. And we said, let's build on that. So we took about 6 months or maybe even 9 months before we bought a single asset. We studied markets. We studied fundamentals for markets using their CFA skill set. We really became intentional and data-driven in our approach and just studied everything we needed to study before we actually deployed capital. And it turned out that the first deal we did was a really great deal. We made a lot. We had a 350% ROI on it. And most people, all the Bigger Pockets podcasts we'd listened to and books we'd read, a lot of people were like, you know, the first deal I broke even, or maybe I lost a little bit of money, but most of it was the learning. We learned a ton and we made a bunch of money on that first deal. And I think that was a testament to the intentionality we brought and the fact that we didn't deploy anything for the first, let's say, 9 months.
Right, man. I love that. I love that you focus on that intentionality, because that's one of the things I think that is hard for us as entrepreneurs, especially the doers, you know, that are listening to this. It's like, man, I want to do something. Last thing I want to do is try and talk about it. Like, give me something to do. Like, let's go knock it out of the park. But so you end up doing a bunch of frenetic activity with no forward progress. So,
right. Yeah, exactly. I would just say, like, that would be probably the summation of my first three entrepreneurial endeavors, you know, in marketing and the adventure travel space and whatever. Like, these were, I was like, I got an idea. Let's just go do it. And like a day later, I had a name for the company and I was already building a website and stuff. And like, I missed the target on the first couple. I should have taken time to sit and think about the why, the market opportunity, et cetera. I kind of did that after the fact, after the business has already gone to market, and I had mentors telling me, hey, you need to go back and like relook at the fundamentals of why you're in this space. Like, I wouldn't have had the same name for my first travel business. I probably would have not chosen to operate it out of Florence, Italy for taxation purposes. There was a lot of different things I would have done differently. I mean, I still had a blast. I learned a lot, but I was that young guy with entrepreneurial fire in my belly, and I just wanted to get to market and start taking people on trips. So, but there's a lot of wisdom in going slow, taking your time, like doing that necessary research. It'll save you time and ultimately money in the end.
Right. Yeah. It's a slow down to speed up kind of principle that, you know, it's tough to implement. So that's really fascinating. On that first deal, did you guys self-fund that? Did you bring investors in? Or what was the financing side of that?
Yeah. So we did self-fund that. This was kind of like, I wrote an article in, or like a post at rather, in Bigger Pockets about it, because it was sort of like the ultimate first multifamily deal. It was a BRRRR. It had seller financing. It had two assets that we parceled one off and sold it as a single family fix and flip. The other was a four unit that was basically almost attached to it. They shared this boundary line. So it was this crazy, you know, kind of Swiss Army knife of multifamily deals. And yeah, we took some some seller financing to get it going. We refinanced it, I think like 9 months or a year later, with a bank loan from a local credit union. And of course, brought our own money in for the down payment and that kind of thing. But it wasn't a lot of money. We self-funded all the rehab costs and things like that. But it wasn't a lot. I think overall, we put like $50K into it of our own money and ended up pulling out, I think, 200 or something like that at the end after all said and done. So it was sweet.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So how did you guys, from that point forward, you said, okay, we did this one deal. Now what's your buy box look like? What is Acris's capital like today?
Yeah. So that was our first portfolio in Eastern Washington. And we bought three smaller multis, you know, that five or that four unit plus the single, a seven unit, a 12 unit. And these were all smaller, older buildings. You know, we could get in, we could get in at a good price from wholesalers or brokers who'd had these kind of uglier deals. And while we were doing that and building our experience, self-funding these things and operating them, asset managing them ourselves, we were also kind of scratching our heads and saying, all right, our whole strategy was to stack our portfolio starting in Washington State up to a couple hundred units. But our mentors at the time, who were successful commercial real estate folks in their own right, were like, you guys are smart enough, like you got enough, you know, energy, you're full-time real estate professionals, like you should be going bigger sooner, and enough with stacking five units and 10 units and 20 units, go big. And so we took that advice after we had the kind of confidence to do it and went to a syndication focused conference here in Colorado that introduced us to a bunch of syndicators, and they were doing deals in the 100 to 500 unit space. And so after getting to know a couple of these teams, they invited us to cooperate with them as members of the GP. And so our buy box went from like small, like 10 to 20 unit multis in Eastern Washington to 100 unit plus assets in Orlando, Florida, Dallas, Fort Worth, and all these kind of big, big kind of showbiz multifamily markets. And our criteria really changed. I had to learn a lot about what the heck, all sorts of stuff. Why a pitched roof or a flat roof? What's galvanized piping and aluminum electric wiring? Like what are all these things I need to keep an eye out for? Chiller systems, et cetera. So we went from like small to large very, very quickly with the help of some experienced kind of mentors taking us under their wing in the syndication space. But if I was to talk about what our buying criteria is right now, we look for 50 to 150 to 200 unit size multifamily assets that are in solid B-class locations or becoming B-class locations within a year. They have reposition, light to medium value add potential on either side of the pro forma. So either rent increases or bringing the expense ratio down. So figuring out different ways to increase net operating income and force valuation. They should be 1980s asset vintage assets, so we can basically stack the cards in our favor and not have a bunch of problems that we end up finding during due diligence. But that said, we do buy stuff in the 60s vintage. But before we were buying stuff earlier than in the late 1800s. Like we bought something that was from 1895. So buy criteria really changed.
Yeah. But your buy criteria changed, but it changed so dramatically. I mean, like 1800s to now, it's like, okay, we're not just buying bigger, but now we're buying a completely different animal altogether when it comes to, you know, bigger assets, different years. Man, I can't believe you bought stuff in the 1800s, by the way. That's nuts. I can't imagine what the renovations look like on that.
Oh, it's nutty. Structural issues. You got to bring engineers in. You find all kinds of weird stuff under the building. And, you know, frankly, though, it's made this new asset, not new asset class, but our current asset class focus of the last few years way, way easier because, you know, I was just down in our market on Monday conducting due diligence on two assets back to back in the morning and the afternoon. One was built in 62, the other was built in 81. And, you know, we've got 15 individuals conducting, you know, the inspection, looking at the roofs and the sewers and the interiors, exteriors, termites, everything. And they all come back and they're like, it's satisfactory. It checks out. This worked. That was great. Like really, these assets are so much cleaner. I'm always expecting to hear like crazy issues with sewer connections and roofing instability and stuff like that. But these assets are just way cleaner and easier to reposition and operate for that matter. So it makes our job way easier. And frankly, to operate a 12 unit built in 1905 is harder than operating a 50 unit built in 1986. So
sure. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the point of the show, you know, is how to scale. And then you just hit it on the head, like focus on the things that require less and you can buy more. Which is right. Just kind of wild and crazy. Walk us through. I know we talked a little bit about the financing side of things, but you guys have had some interesting iterations in kind of who your investor base is. Can you kind of tell us that process as you guys have grown your business?
Sure. So we broke our investor relations and capital raising effort into three tiers: tier one, tier two, and tier three. Tier one were the people that we were kind of when we stopped using our own money, or when we began needing to bring additional capital in from besides our own. We immediately looked to family and friends, people that we knew very intimately that had worked with us or related to us, and that was the beginning. And we found that that group was really, really instrumental in getting our business going, and we were forever grateful and thankful to them. And they do continue to invest with us. But as we grew our business, we started going from tier one into tier two, which is folks that we met networking or through organizations that we're a part of, or found us by referral from another friend or something like this. And as we got a little further away from our friends and family group, you know, I would say that the relational risk became less because there was less concern that, you know, a deal didn't work out. We'd be at odds with a family member sitting across the table from them at Thanksgiving, which never happened or has never happened. But that concern was always in our minds when we were having those conversations with those people. Like, frankly, their relationships are way more important than their capital. Sure. And so when we moved beyond that group, it was in terms of like creating new relationships and building new leads with them. It was actually a little bit of a sigh of relief and moving into the tier twos, because there's a degree of separation from our actual friends and family group. And I would also say that the tier two group was a little bit more, you know, there was a whole variety of folks that were focused on investing 50 to 100K kind of retail side investors who, And then there's the group in there that were looking to invest a bit more money, that maybe were more professional investors and had invested in many, many assets over decades of time. And so we began to realize that some of the conversations with them tended to be a little bit easier just because they had a higher level of understanding of the types of assets we were buying. They were more comfortable investing out of their own backyard in their own market. They understood some of the more sophisticated jargon related to underwriting different business plans and different return profiles and that kind of thing. And so we began to realize that a single conversation with one high net worth individual who wants to deploy $500,000 to $2 million tended to be a little bit easier and generally more efficient than having 10 or 20 conversations with a variety of retail investors who certainly we still support and want to continue to work with and educate, but it just required a little more energy to educate them. A little more questions were asked and a lot more meetings. And so if I was as one individual, capital raising goals in mind, it's easier for me to go to a couple of high net worth individuals who have less education needs and can deploy capital more quickly than a few dozen folks that are going to require a lot more education. So we, while we still do really support and are very thankful for our the majority of our retail investor base, and we still aim to bring them deals, we also are focusing kind of in parallel on helping to support the higher net worth individuals who have deployment needs on average of around $800,000. So that's kind of a new focus for us that's been really helpful in our capital raising strategy.
Right, right. And I love that. I love that. You gave a lot of good pointers there as to why you guys are kind of moving in that direction. And it makes a lot of sense. You know, it's just easier. It's easier. They can write bigger checks. It's less conversations. And I think the other interesting thing in that is that not just the relief of risk, because obviously, you know, we never want to lose a dollar, right? No one wants to lose a dollar. But at the same time, when you start playing in the big leagues with bigger investors, they have a risk tolerance that's probably a little bit different than the person that's doing their first syndication. Maybe they're an accredited investor, but still not that familiar with real estate. It's like, gosh, all right, 50 grand, that's a lot of money. Like, right. I'm not sure that's going to work out. But, you know, when you're playing with the big boys, it's like, okay, and big, you know, then, hey, you know, this is the risk associated with what we're doing. So let's go do it.
Yeah. Yeah. They've got a totally different return profile, different risk appetite. And, you know, some have higher risk, some have different lower risk, or they have different needs entirely. They might not be caring about cash flow. They might care only about total return. They might not care about really either of those and really just want to mitigate tax events. And so they're trying to defray tax liability of a spouse who has active income as a, you know, so there's a lot of different needs that they have that we've learned a lot about and have gotten pretty good at identifying and supporting. So it's been an interesting education for me. And I think we're providing a lot of value now to a wide swath of investors, from family and friends and retail investors to the higher net worth folks. And we're proud to have that, you know, group to work with and bring different deals to. Because there's also tons of deals. Deals are few and far between right now. But there are deals that come through that simply aren't going to work for high net worth individuals. They're perfect for retail investors, perfect for a deal to syndicate and a larger syndication. And so, you know, we keep those in mind for those folks as well.
Yeah. And I think one last question here before we jump into the final four, but how are you guys structuring your deals to meet the various needs of the different investor profiles?
Yeah. So it really depends upon who that audience is and who that investor is. If it's the retail investor, they are going to look at a pretty typical syndication kind of best practice where we do a 70-30 LPGP split with potentially a preferred return, but maybe not these days, a 5 to 7 year hold period. And we target a minimum of a 9 to 10% cash on cash return and somewhere between 13 and 25% IRR. So that's kind of the numbers you got to hit to attract retail investors these days. You know, when it comes to the other deals and say we're working specifically with a high net worth individual, it can be a whole range of return profiles and structures, different hold periods. Maybe we can hold it for a longer period or into perpetuity. You know, I think that a lot of high net worth individuals aren't interested in cashing out, because once they do, they've got to redeploy that capital. And that's a good problem to have, but it's still a problem to have when you've got a lot of capital and a lot of liquidity. It just sits right around and doesn't work for you. So they want to hold these things in perpetuity. And so we can structure a deal such that we can maybe refinance if the market conditions, you know, permit, pull out some of their capital so they can redeploy it somewhere else, but they can maintain an equity position and hold it into perpetuity. So there's a lot of different ways we can structure those deals after it works on a project basis. I would say that first and foremost. If a deal doesn't work on a project basis, the deal is not going to work when you slice it nice and structure it for different investors and different return profiles, frankly. And that's the reason why we've only acquired 3 assets in the last year and a half, because most of them don't work, cap rates as low as they are. So Yeah, you got to be really selective. But if it works on a project basis, then we can usually make it work for a whole host of investor needs.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's something interesting that we're seeing more and more of is these kind of, because it used to be a lot of the deals I saw were, you know, like you said, pretty retail, 70-30 preferred return. Okay, basic. But now we're seeing, you know, some iterations of that with class of shares, with, you know, one getting a higher preferred, but no equity participation on the, you know, upside upon the exit. You know, we're seeing right. Lower preferreds with, you know, participation upon the, you know, on the upside on exit and things like that. And I think those are just interesting kind of how this space is becoming more educated and how we're also meeting the needs of various investors along the way is really just a fascinating really topic. Hey, I've certainly enjoyed this. It's been tons of fun. Let's jump here into the final four. And I do apologize, but the final four questions have changed. So you may have gotten a notification of it here, but we ended up, and I've said this a couple of times already, but this is the first week of recording the new final four questions. We had about 250 or 60 episodes of the same questions. We got a lot of the same answers. So they're all new questions. Or excuse me, the first two questions are new ones. But here we go. First question is this. If I gave you just $20,000 to invest in real estate, what would you do with it and why?
$20,000, I'd probably end up lending it. It's not really enough money to really get yourself a significant equity stake in any particular deal. If I was just getting started, I'd use that money to fund myself to go out and hunt down a deal and find my own deal, like kind of take it down, maybe do some direct marketing. But if I'm in the stage I'm in right now, I'd probably take that money and put it into some kind of a debt fund or support a developer who's doing a condo conversion or something like this and get myself a minimum of a 10 to 20% return with a lien position on that deal just to keep it safe. That's probably what I would do with it.
Right. I love that. Question number two, if you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
One mistake in real estate. I don't know, getting caught up in all the hype. You know, I see a ton of kind of thought leaders and influencers and folks out there with big Instagram followings and stuff like that. And while there's a lot of good information out there and there's a lot of people doing really good work, there's a lot of people that are kind of showbiz and really trying to, like, I don't know, just overhype this whole thing. And I think it's easy to get yourself distracted. I think we didn't get involved with any educators or any thought leaders. We just kind of figured it out on our own and kept our heads down in our own market and went out and got busy and bought something and stopped talking to networking. We didn't stop networking, but we didn't let it influence us too much. We just said, let's get out there, get busy, find something to buy and learn on our own. Like, everybody's going to have an opinion on this, and opinions are cheap and easy to give, and you got to learn on your own. Certainly, I think there's a lot of really good resources, written resources like Bigger Pockets. That's really all the information I think you really need if you're getting going. But just try to stay focused and not get carried away by shiny object syndrome. So it's just easy to get waylaid. Just stay focused, stick with the fundamentals, like the 1% rule and investing your own dollars and getting going and just figure it out.
Right. No, I love that. Question number three, investing in the world. What's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Yeah, a couple things. This is really important to us. So kind of conscious capitalism is an important part of our business and becoming more important now that our own financial needs are taken care of and more taken care of than we really need. It's like, okay, what can we now do to give beyond our own needs? And a big part of that is seeing in our local communities, both where we live and invest, how can we support people in the affordable housing space? You know, we do our best to protect value in our own markets where we invest by not just getting in and, you know, bringing rents up above market appropriate levels. We try to really, in our own investing and our own asset management, keep things fair. But also we've brought in our own, we've started a new strategy essentially in the last couple of quarters that focuses on impact investing, where we do a private partnership with a 501c3 that allows us to go in and have some governance over increasing rent that's market appropriate. And that way we can have the assets that we acquire continue to be value and affordable housing in the private space in the markets that we acquire. And that gives us some different benefits on the actual balance sheet as well, or on the pro forma as well. But certainly we want to see if we can protect affordable housing for the different markets since it's such a critical need. And the final thing I'd say is we have struck up some partnerships with Habitat for Humanity, both here in Boulder, Colorado, and Colorado and out in Boston. My partner just joined the board here in Boulder, and my other partner is helping to interview families who are interested in building their homes out in Boston. And so beginning to build relationships with really forward-thinking international organizations like Habitat for Humanity is another way that we're going to continue to give back and grow our kind of conscious capitalism as our business scales.
Right, man. That's awesome. I love that. Charlie, if listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, so the best way, acrascapital.com. We have a variety of different channels. You can reach out specifically to me. That's acrascapital.com. Like I said, we're currently looking to bring in more higher net worth individuals into the stable who are looking to invest $250 to $2 million per deal. If you have any interest in working kind of in a more boutique way or a more customized way with our team, go to our website, fill out an investor application. It's really easy to do, and that'll come directly to my inbox, and I'll have a review and then get in touch with you. Also, if you're interested in deploying smaller amounts of capital, 50 to 100K, certainly come and check us out and fill out an investor application as well. We still want to open the doors to all investors that are interested in getting into multifamily real estate. And yeah, connect with me. You can also find us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, all the different social media assets. So look forward to connecting with you. And Sam, thanks so much for a great podcast. Good questions. Really appreciated it.
Hey, thank you, Charlie, for coming on. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks. You too.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.